We need honeybees to pollinate crops, or maybe other bees could help.
We've found that they can carry up to 100 times more pollen on their bodies than what a honeybee can.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, as honeybee populations struggle, other bees step up. And a Republican governor running for president has environmentalists and his own party scratching their heads. Plus, we head to the beach looking for shorebirds, but better not get too close. All that and more is coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. It's back to the drawing board for the EPA in its effort to prevent cross-state air pollution. A federal appeals court this week ordered the agency to relax the limits it set on sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide that drifts from one state to another. Pennsylvania is one of 13 states affected by the rule. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the cross-state air pollution rule. States and industry groups challenged how it was applied. This week's lower court decision sent the rule back to EPA, saying that in its current form, the rule is overly strict. The pollutants in question cause smog and soot. The number of Republican candidates for president is up to 17. And the latest to toss his hat into the ring is familiar to many in our region, Ohio Governor John Kasich. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant takes a look at Kasich's environmental views and at his record.
In the Republican presidential field, there are some climate deniers. Texan Ted Cruz, for one, calls climate change pseudoscientific theory.
Debates on this should follow science and should follow data. And many of the alarmists on global warming, they got a problem because the science doesn't back them up.
Almost all climate scientists agree that human activity is causing changes in the climate. So when Ohio Governor John Kasich announced his candidacy, he stood out in part because he acknowledges that climate change is real. Kasich was asked about it this summer after Pope Francis called for action on climate change. Some GOP candidates, like Jeb Bush, criticized the pontiff for speaking out. But Kasich had a different response.
Climate change, look, I respect what the Pope said. I mean, my feeling is that what he said, that we have an obligation to the environment.
The question for many is what a President Kasich would do about it.
So would you take legislative action?
Well, let's not get carried away.
Kasich has come out against action by the Obama administration to curb carbon emissions that cause climate change. Obama's Clean Power Plan aims to cut a third of carbon emissions from the electricity sector by 2030. That would be a tough pill to swallow in Ohio, where two-thirds of the electricity came from coal last year. Emissions from coal are considered the largest contributor to global climate change in the U.S. Kasich has said the state will continue to burn coal without apology. Under his leadership, Ohio joined a lawsuit to challenge the Clean Power Plan rules before they were released. The lawsuit failed.
Governor Kasich is not necessarily your truest, bluest, greenest friend or the environment, nor absolutely is he an enemy, outright arch enemy of the environment.
That's Jack Shaner of the Ohio Environmental Council. Kasich was slammed by environmental groups last year for freezing Ohio's renewable energy program for 2 years. The program required utilities to replace some energy from coal with alternatives like solar and wind. But Shaner says without Kasich, the Republican legislature would have completely eliminated the clean energy mandate.
Governor Kasich gets credit for salvaging and holding the wolf from the door, so we did not suffer an outright repeal of our clean energy standards. We were disappointed he wasn't more active earlier in that debate and didn't exert his leadership and get this legislature to back down.
Kasich is split with some in his own party by pushing a tax on the oil and gas industry. There's a similar debate in Pennsylvania. Many Republicans say it would drive the industry away. Here's Kasich at his State of the State speech earlier this year.
I'm disappointed by those that say the severance tax reform will kill the industry. That's a joke. That's a big fat joke, because I've talked to them in private. And I'll tell you what, our severance tax will still be competitive with other energy-rich states.
The Ohio Environmental Council praises Kasich for these efforts and for preventing oil and gas drilling in state parks. The group's Jack Shaner says Kasich has also put big bucks toward reducing toxic algae in Lake Erie. On the other hand, Shaner says Kasich started something called the Common Sense Initiative that's made it difficult to create new environmental regulation, especially if it comes at any cost to the private sector.
So here again, this is sort of the mystique of John Kasich. You cannot just categorize the guy. He is complicated.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Some people are afraid of bees. Scientists at Penn State University are not among them.
Scientifically, I appreciate them, but on a personal level, I just feel giddy when I see this many bees.
Find out why researchers are feeling warm and buzzy about bee species that could help pollinate crops as honeybee populations decline. That's later on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. Sustainability means green, right? Wind turbines, solar panels, being environmentally friendly. But as our intern, Dale Shoemaker, found out, sustainability isn't always about saving the earth. Sometimes it's about the bottom line.
At the Screaming Crow Tattoo Shop in Pittsburgh, they're getting ready to cover a woman's unwanted flower tattoo with a purple and green cupcake.
This is my liner, that's my shader.
But this tattoo is a little bit different than most. It's locally sourced. The shop was too loud, so I walked to a coffee shop next door with the Screaming Crow's owner, Eric Corbin, to find out more. Corbin's arms are covered with tattoos. He says all of the shop's ink, tubes, and needles come from a wholesaler about 7 miles from the shop.
I go a little bit out of my way to do it, but it's the right thing to do for me, you know.
Corbin wants to distinguish the Screaming Crow as a sustainable small business, so he buys local and recycles. He also bought something called an autoclave to sterilize the equipment. It allows the shop to reuse the steel tubes that hold the ink.
A lot of artists are using disposable tubes and stuff like that, where you just use it once and kind of throw it away because it's a piece of plastic. Well, that's a lot of plastic going out the door, you know what I mean?
Reducing waste, buying local, these are things Corbin actually checked off on an official list, created by Sustainable Pittsburgh. The group's Matt Mahalik helps businesses meet the criteria to become a designated sustainable business. They get a ranking, bronze, silver, or gold. About 90 businesses are going through the process. The list includes everything from diversity in the workforce to energy conservation to transportation. Mahalik says when the tattoo shop buys its steel tubes, it not only reduces waste, it can also help other businesses and their workers.
At least that wholesaler is employed here in Pittsburgh. There's probably a group of employees working here, rather than that whole thing being outsourced somewhere else.
Buying local may help the local economy, but it's not necessarily the best decision for the planet. Researcher Chris Weber found this out in 2008, when the local food movement was taking off. Weber measured how much carbon dioxide was being produced when food was grown and when it was shipped. He found that producing some foods, like beef, creates a lot of CO2. But whether that food was trucked across the country or just around the city didn't make much difference.
The carbon footprint of producing the food is much more important than where the food comes from, or, you know, in short, what you eat matters more than where it comes from a carbon footprint standpoint.
Weber says buying local doesn't reduce climate impacts. So where does this leave the Screaming Crow in its quest to become sustainable? Matt Mahalik of Sustainable Pittsburgh says it doesn't change a thing.
Most people think of sustainability as an environmental issue, and to put it bluntly, environment is something that had been off the radar screen entirely.
Sustainable Pittsburgh's checklist for businesses includes things like efficiency in transport, energy, and water usage. But Mahalik says those aren't on the list to help the environment. They're good business practices, the same as good ethics and providing a career path for employees.
All those things are important aspects for the long-term sustainability, and in many cases, the short-term sustainability of your business.
The Screaming Crow got a silver ranking from Sustainable Pittsburgh for its reuse, recycling, and local sourcing. The guys there are glad to be recognized as a business trying to help the city and its people in a lasting way. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Dale Shoemaker.
We love diving into a good summer mystery, but you don't need to turn to Pulp Fiction for a good story. They're all around us. For example, Jeff Gordon remembers seeing moths, lots of them, during childhood summers with his grandparents in Delaware. Now, well...
It used to be like a blizzard, and now it's a few flurries.
Gordon wanted to know...
Do the observations of scientists, do they square with my own memories? Because my memories seem vivid.
David Wagner, an ecology professor at the University of Connecticut, says Gordon's not wrong. In fact, Wagner wrote a paper about it called Moth Decline in the Northeastern United States. But what's happening and why is complicated. It varies by species and state, and factors could include development, light pollution, and climate change. So it's still a mystery. Wagner says that's where you come in.
This is a case where citizen scientists and people taking notes in their backyard and making observations in their backyard could generate the very data we need to sort of solve this conundrum.
If you love a good mystery too, you can help us tell more stories like this through Icy Change. It's the crowdsourced online almanac of weather and climate. You just go to iseechange.org, log in, and post comments or questions about what you're seeing outside. Then we do a little digging, find scientists to answer your questions, and see where the clues lead us. Join us at iseechange.org for a little scientific sleuthing. Earlier this year, the Obama administration announced a new initiative aimed at reversing the major declines in U.S. honeybees, which are crucial to the nation's food economy. More than 40% of U.S. honeybee colonies didn't make it through the winter last year. That's a continuation of a decades-long trend. Bee researchers are starting to look at how other species of bees could help fill the gaps. The Allegheny Front's Lou Bluen reports.
If you want to hang out with a bunch of bees, you better be prepared for a little pain.
I hope you don't get stung, but I probably get. I mean, I've already been stung a few times today.
That's Mario Padilla. He's a research tech at Penn State University who works with honeybees. And in fact, if you ever wanted to know what a bee sting sounds like, here you go. As Mario's explaining something, a worker lands right on the microphone and tries to take it out.
Old enough to go out into the world, and as we can see on the mic right now, there's a bee trying to sting it. If that was your skin, you would have gotten stung.
Mario's raising these honeybees for researchers like Marianne Frazier, who says it's almost as if honeybees aren't just a species anymore. They've become a system, a technology that we literally pack in boxes, load onto semi-trucks, and ship all over the country to do work for us.
So the first crop to be pollinated in the spring is almonds. And about a third of the colonies in the United States are trucked out to California to pollinate one crop.
After that, beekeepers load them up and truck them all the way back to Pennsylvania to pollinate apples and cherries.
Then they'll go up to Maine and pollinate blueberries, and Massachusetts and pollinate cranberries.
And you get the idea.
It is a huge, huge business.
But it's also a business that's wearing honeybees out. A combination of diseases, stress, parasites, pesticides, colony collapse disorder, a mysterious phenomenon which scientists still don't understand, have all taken their toll on honeybees. And that could put our own species in a tight spot. Honeybees pollinate about a third of the crops in the U.S. That's about $15 billion of the food economy. So does that mean it's time to panic? Well, not necessarily.
So what happens if we lose the honeybee? Well, it's not the end of the world.
That's Dave Bittinger. He's also a researcher at Penn State. And if he sounds confident, he is. That's because scientists like Dave are starting to see that other bees, unsung bees, could start picking up some of the slack. His all-star bee that he's studying right now is a type of Osmia bee that was introduced a few decades ago called the Japanese orchard bee.
We call them jobs for short because people don't like Latin names.
And these jobs, well, at least in apple orchards, they're kind of showing up honeybees.
Honeybee's a little bit lazy. It'll only maybe visit one or two flowers per minute. And Osmia will do up to 15 flowers per minute. And you'll see some of these bees, once they've been on here, they'll be completely coated. Their whole body's really hairy. And we've seen with Osmia, they can carry up to 100 times more pollen than what a honeybee can.
In fact, Dave says some apple farmers are finding they can forego renting honeybees altogether because these Osmia and the 200 other species of bees that live wild in and around the orchards are getting the job done. And that's just the tip of the other bee iceberg.
Oh, look at all these bees on the Monarda. Scientifically, I appreciate them, but on a personal level, I just feel giddy when I see this many bees.
That's Carly Miller. She's a grad student in the Penn State Entomology Department. And today, She's in a pumpkin patch looking for squash bees.
The squash bees are like little Wall Street bees, and they fly around quickly everywhere, fast, ping, ping. They like barely look in a flower, and then they're off to the next one, and they can't decide what to do with themselves. And half the time they'll fly into you because they're so busy flying and fall into a flower, and they're like, oh, okay, I'll use this one.
For a long time, nobody even knew squash bees were such hard workers. In fact, pumpkin farmers would often rent honeybees, not realizing they probably already had squash bees on their farms doing most of the pollination. But squash bees don't deserve all the credit. Like a lot of bees, they don't live for very long as free-roaming adults, only about 4 or 5 weeks. And at that point in the season, bumblebees take over the pumpkin patch. And just like in apple orchards, scientists are finding that between these two kinds of bees, farmers can probably get by without using honeybees. It's all part of a new strategy of diversification that entomologist Shelby Fleischer affectionately refers to as Plan B.
I think the key to remember is resilience. So don't just aim for any one species. Historically, there's been a lot of emphasis on let's make honeybees our pollinator. And resilience would suggest that we should try and support a community of bees.
And that is where things can get tricky, because for the most part, other bees don't act like honeybees. Honeybees are freaks in the bee world. They live in a box. You can move them from place to place. They reproduce like crazy. They eat practically anything. Most other bees are actually solitary. They nest in dead trees or in the ground, so you can't move them around. So to keep a healthy, diverse population of other bees on the farm, Carly Miller says farmers will have to start adding bee habitat, like wildflower patches, next to their fields, so that these other bees have something to eat and something to live in year-round.
So it's planting your floral resources, making sure you choose the right flowers that are going to come up early enough, that have pollen resources, that have nectar resources, and that will finish their bloom early enough so that when all the crops are available, the bees then switch to a new food source and are doing the pollination in your crops.
Which is not exactly an easy formula to figure out, and is something scientists are just now starting to work on. It varies crop by crop and even region by region. That's why even with all this excitement over other bees, researcher Marianne Frazier says we won't be walking away from honeybees anytime soon.
So there are cases, and there will continue to be, I think, cases where we might have niches for certain kinds of bees. But in terms of having a bee that is as versatile as honeybees, that bee doesn't exist. I mean, it just isn't out there.
Most importantly, Marianne says, what's good for all other bees, habitat, a diverse diet, fewer pesticides, is good for honeybees. So you do good by one species, you do good by all of them. And they'll continue to do good by all of us, at least most of the time.
I got stung. And that was a sting that was not even an invited sting. I was minding my own business sting.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
I'm used to it. Don't worry about it. I might scream, but it'll be okay.
Sweeter than a honeybee, yeah. Baby, been sweet on me. Sweeter than a honeybee.
Avian flu has already had a devastating impact on Midwestern chicken and turkey farms. Over 40 million birds have died this year, some killed in an effort to stop the fast-moving disease from spreading. Agricultural fairs have even canceled poultry events. So far, flocks in Pennsylvania and Ohio have avoided the disease. But the fall migration of waterfowl, which carry avian flu, has some poultry producers worried. Here to talk about the potential risk is Margaret Brittingham. She's professor of wildlife resources in Penn State's College of Agricultural Sciences. Hi, Margaret. Thanks for talking with me.
Good morning, Kara.
So briefly, what is avian flu and how does it affect infected birds?
Avian influenza is a virus. It's very similar to the influenza or flu that people get also. The variation that's of concern is a highly pathogenic avian influenza, and it's called highly pathogenic because it causes extreme mortality in chickens and other poultry. The natural reservoir for this virus, though, is waterfowl. And so waterfowl can carry it. Shorebirds can also carry it. And they don't show outward signs of disease. And so what happens is that they are able to carry it, spread the virus in their droppings, but not be sick themselves.
So ducks, waterfowl have been raising their young in southern Canada, in the upper Midwest, but now they're about to migrate south to their wintering grounds. How could this be a problem in spreading avian flu to Pennsylvania or to eastern flocks?
Last December, we had the first case of highly pathogenic avian influenza, and it was discovered in the western U.S. And for waterfowl, there are four sort of major flyways that they move down: the Pacific flyway, which is in the far west, the central, in the center part of the state, the Mississippi, which follows the Mississippi River drainage, and then the eastern flyway. And avian influenza was detected in three flyways, the Pacific, the Central, and the Mississippi. It has not yet been detected in the eastern flyway. But what happens is during the breeding grants, many of these birds from different flyways are all mixing together and breeding. And so there's the potential that a bird may have become infected while up there on the breeding grounds. Then as they migrate down, they've got the potential to bring that disease into a new area. And so the concern is that as birds migrate, we may be seeing it being brought into areas where it has not been before.
How likely is that?
I think it's pretty likely. Since December, it has been identified in 21 states. So that's fairly widespread. The disease does not do well at high temperatures. So during the summer months, we've seen sort of a slowdown in it. So I think the last case that was detected was mid-June. But as temperatures cool and birds start moving into new areas, I think there's a high potential of it coming in.
You mentioned droppings. Can you explain a little bit more about how the disease is spread by these migrating birds or wild birds?
Yeah. So when a bird is infected, so let's say a duck, and really dabbling ducks, and those are the ducks that don't dive deep into the water, but they feed sort of on the surface. So mallards, black ducks, pintails, greenwing tails are all examples of dabbling ducks. Those are the species that are most likely to be carriers, or are the natural reservoir. And they're dropping. So if you know, like our Canada geese, you see droppings around a wetland where they've stopped. Those could harbor the disease also in saliva, nasal excretions, things like that. So just in the environment where they are or where they've flown over, you could have it. The disease then can persist for maybe up to 2 weeks in ideal conditions, which are sort of cool, moist temperatures, conditions we might have during the fall. And so the concern is that they would be there in that environment. You would go out, you know, maybe you go to a duck pond to watch waterfowl and pick it up on your shoe, you know, pick up the virus on your shoes and take it to a new area, or even vehicles coming into areas where there are waterfowl gathering.
What can poultry producers do to protect local flocks?
For you as a poultry producer, you need to, first of all, be aware of the signs of the disease. Because if you do see a sick bird or have a sick bird, eradication is the way to go. They show reduced activity, so they're very sort of sluggish and slow. They may have like kind of a swollen-looking head. Number two, or really it's number one, is to practice good biosecurity. And most of the commercial producers are well aware of what they need to do because of the problems that have happened in the Midwest. But this includes, you know, not having any contact with wild birds. So those facilities would be wildlife tight so that you don't get other birds coming into them. You want to control the human traffic coming into the area so you don't want to have visitors coming in. Let's say trucks that are coming to, I don't know, pick up eggs or whatever, but you want the vehicles to practice good biosecurity so you don't have a truck going from one poultry facility and then driving over to another one without going through some kind of disinfectant or washing off the tires. For people who are backyard poultry owners, you know, those birds are usually exposed, obviously, to wild birds because many of them are outside. At this point, if we find the disease coming into the state, you definitely don't want to bring new birds into your flock. You want to, again, limit contact with other chickens. That's why we've stopped fairs this fall of having poultry being at shows.
Does avian flu harm, I know it doesn't harm these waterfowl themselves, but does it harm other wild birds, or is there any danger that humans could become infected?
Influenza viruses are known for their ability to recombine and resort, and that's why we always have to get a different flu vaccine every year. They have to recreate it. But at this point, this has not been a human health issue. In terms of wild birds, there's not a lot that we know about that. We do know that it does kill raptors, and so hawks and owls. are killed by this, and so there's concerns. One of the first cases was, I can't remember which raptor, but I can't remember. But anyway, it was fed waterfowl that had been killed by avian influenza. It got avian influenza and died immediately. There's a concern for birds like peregrine falcon, which is a recovering species that feeds quite heavily on waterfowl. So that would be a species that could be impacted by it. For wild birds, there are concerns, there are local concerns that what could happen, but they're not at the level of disease spread because those birds are so widely distributed that they're not likely to be spreading it.
Where did this bird flu, there are a couple of different strains, where did it come from?
You're right, there are a number of different strains of avian flu, and the highly pathogenic avian influenza was initially in Asia, and that's where it's been since 2005 or 2006. And the thought is that birds that were migrating or wintering down in that area came up to breed along maybe eastern Russia or western Alaska. And at that point, there was mixing between birds that were also within the coming into North America.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay, thank you, Kara.
Margaret Brittingham is professor of wildlife resources in Penn State's College of Agricultural Sciences. For more information from Penn State Extension about avian flu and links to more stories about the disease, go to our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
And now the Allegheny Front's Bird Files, our segment with an eye toward the sky, or in this case, the beach. Today we learn about the spotted sandpiper. While other shorebirds can be difficult to identify, you can't miss their spotty plumage. But if you look even more closely, you could notice something surprising. Bird Files contributor Mary Birdsong explains.
In a world where we assume it's always mama bird sitting on the nest, the spotted sandpiper has a secret. The female of the species is quite the cad, laying her eggs and leaving the male to incubate and care for the chicks. In fact, female spotties, as we like to call them, may go on to mate with up to 4 males, and the egg she lays for one male may actually be fathered by a different male in a previous mating. Once those eggs are in the nest and dad is on duty, if you get too close, he may scold you with a harsh whining call. Scientists call the female's breeding strategy polyandry. It may account for the spotted sandpiper being the most abundant and widespread breeding sandpiper in North America. Another reason for their abundance is that they aren't too picky about habitat. They can be found near any kind of freshwater and along the ocean shore. This sandpiper's distinctive spotted chest and bobbing tail make it easy to recognize, unlike many shorebirds, which are notoriously hard to identify. Its multi-part wheat, wheat, wheat call will help you clinch the identification. So now you know, if you ever spot a spotty with some chicks, it's dad chasing after the youngins. For the Allegheny Front Bird Files, I'm Mary Birdsong.
Mary Birdsong is part of the Presque Isle Audubon Society. Bird calls for that segment were provided by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You can find out more about birds in our region and the latest bird research by following our Bird Files Twitter feed, at AFBirds. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Julie Grant's our managing editor. Thanks to Eli Chen of Delaware Public Media for audio in the IC Change segment. Don't forget to go to icchange.org to see what it's all about. And join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.